So this is the final session of the day. This is the journalist panel, and true to their profession, they've all arrived late, so they will have missed quite a lot of what we've talked about today, and we've touched on some really interesting points. So while they're thinking about what they're going to say, I'm just going to summarise a few of the points that I found the most interesting today, and some of the ones that I think might be of most relevance to this particular panel. So We've talked a bit about how journalism should deal with risk and uncertainty and the various kinds of framing. I want to know from the panelists, do they find it annoying when they're faced with the kind of equivocation from scientists that Emily highlighted in her focus groups, where I was quite surprised to see just how it may have been selective video clips, but just how irritated some of those members of the public were when faced with someone who they thought was an expert and who was going to tell them what was what, the bag of facts that science isn't, as Chris Rapley has told us, and then actually find themselves faced with, well, it may be this or it may be that, and we don't really know. Also, I want to hear a bit about how you deal with that kind of science, which is fraught with uncertainty. Obviously, we've spoken mostly about climate change today, climate science practically being synonymous with uncertainty these days. But it doesn't play well to a news agenda. Or rather, that's what I always assumed until David Spiegelhalter, right at the beginning of today, told us that it might be oversimplistic to say that journalists want certainty. I've always certainly thought that editors want certainty, but maybe it's not quite true for journalists, especially the specialist journalists that we've got on our panel now. So I'd like to find out whether that's true or not. Also, are scientists and science communicators doing it all wrong? You beat yourselves up a lot, climate scientists in the room, about this. Maybe you should be more like the epidemiologists who are quite happy after one data set to make public health pronouncements. I know that the same David Spiegelhalter would choke on his samosa if he thought that all scientists should do it that way, but they certainly get into the news. On the other hand, Simon Jenkins, who I regularly disagree with, but he said the other day, I wish scientists would just say, I don't know, more often when they're interviewed in answer to questions. Would that be suitable to any kind of science, or might you as well not have that scientist up for interview at all? So what all these panelists have in common is a career in journalism, having reported on some of the highest profile science, health and environment stories of the last decade at least. In the face of not only uncertainty in science, but also having taken a bashing from all sides at various points in all of their careers as they've laboured to report something truthfully. So I'm just going to give, by way of brief introduction, to my right, Roger Harabin, environment analyst for the BBC. And his position gives him rather more freedom than some of his colleagues to follow his own angles and stories without always being chained to the diary of journal articles or institutional announcements, as some of his peers are. And he's been a critic in the past of media attitude to risk reporting and also disproportionate policy announcements according to perceived risks rather than real risks. Next is Fiona Harvey, formerly environment correspondent for the Financial Times, where she's had to fight hard for fair representation of weight of evidence on climate science, especially, particularly through all the various gates of Climate Gate, Glacier Gate, Himalaya Gate. I don't know if we use the gates anymore, but you'll remember them. And COP15, which feels like a long time ago now, approaching COP18. And she now covers environment and energy issues for The Guardian. And then representing all other science stories which are not climate science, we have Kate Kelland, who reports on science and health for Reuters News Agency. And like many other journalists in March last year, found herself having to report on the Fukushima crisis in Japan following the tsunami, having to write lots of stories about risk from radiation in the face of a developing story which was absolutely fraught with uncertainty. So that's our panel. I'm going to hand over to Roger to talk for a few minutes first, because that's his slide. And Roger, you can use the lectern if you want to, but it's up to you. You can stay here at the mic if you wish. We're going to have just a few minutes from each panelist this time rather than a full presentation, and then the rest of it will be discussion. Roger, thank you.
Okay, well, hello everybody. Thank you for inviting me. This is from a different era when I was at this place doing a sabbatical with the Reuters Foundation, a blessed period, in which I pulled away from the environment to look at another one of my interests, which is how the media reports on health. And I have a long-standing niggle about the way the media reports on issues of societal risk, and think these issues are very easily swayed by lobby groups of one side or another, industry groups. Already? Thank you. No. You see, behind the scenes, money always talks. Anyway, thank you for that light relief, Fiona. So I was interested in particular in public health, because at the time, all of the media was obsessed with the NHS in crisis. Now, should anybody put up their hand if they know a year when the NHS wasn't in crisis? Okay, the NHS lurches from crisis to crisis. It's in permanent crisis. And I felt that the so-called crisis in the NHS at the time, although no doubt genuine, was also probably masking some bigger issues. So, for instance, it was impossible to get a story into the papers about smoking or drinking or mental health or any of these issues, because kind of people knew about them. And so I spent a bit of time, in a previous sabbatical at Cambridge, I was looking at what made the elements of news. And my conclusion was, well, I don't know, a lot of journalists may not have the conclusion for this. My little list is novelty. Something has to either be new or appear to be new. It doesn't matter if it only appears to be new, so long as other people haven't heard about it. So it needs novelty. We need some element of drama, preferably conflict if we can. Personality, increasingly nowadays, helps us tell a story. Pictures are very useful. And there are some other elements too. But if you don't have those elements, particularly with that element of novelty, you can't do a story. If you're a news journalist, if something isn't new, it isn't news. And if it isn't news, it isn't news. So I got some help from the King's Fund who offered me a research assistant who did some number crunching on health stories in newspapers and BBC. And this was a very quick and dirty piece of research, the sort of piece of research only an unscrupulous journalist could possibly do, and trying to ascertain how many people needed to die from any given ailment to get a slot on the news. And the numbers, as you can see, are really rather low. VCJD, that was the mad cow disease scare, where there were three stories to every dead person. Measles, the MMR scare, there were four stories for every dead person from measles. Whereas you can see the other side, you know, smoking, obesity, alcohol, mental illnesses, vast disproportion. Now, having said that, we got a bunch of journalists along to the launch at the King's Fund, and I think they were extremely sceptical. I'm an interloper in this area, and I think a lot of people came very sceptical. I think a lot left very sceptical, but having said that, since then, public health reporting does seem to be more in vogue, and we are more able to talk about the balance of risks. And we're also, what interests me is getting a discussion in society about who takes the risk, who's the risk imposed on, who pays for the other person to take the risk, and all those sort of conversations have been opened up as well. I think partly, you know, this has possibly helped in that. I guess most of my other comments will be talking about environmental risks, because that's what I mainly focus on, and I have plenty to say. But I think I'll sit down now and let you bring the other guys in. So.
That's fine. Thank you. Okay, do you want to go next?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. I don't actually have any slides, and I don't have any cash anymore because I've just sprayed it all over the stage, so I apologise for that. But thank you, Tom, for the kind introductions. And thank you, Roger, for that that excellent summary of some of the reporting of risk in the media. I think we'll find that very telling. And Roger has been very good in gathering some statistics for that. I haven't managed to get any statistics. What I'm going to give you is a few impressions from my time reporting at various places about these subjects, generally about scientific subjects. And what I can tell you, first of all, is that the most important thing you must remember in reading any news story that's got anything to do with science, facts, any technical matters, or indeed anything that's not subject to total political manipulation, the one thing you must never do is to trust anyone who's writing from the lobby. The lobby is, of course, the group of journalists who are based in the House of Commons. They are non-specialists. They are people who listen to politicians all day, and, well, there you go. They are people who are constantly fed a constant stream of leaks. They've got more leaks than Thames water. And they're fed these by special advisors who come into the lobby, who will take a journalist aside and say, "I'm not saying this to anyone else, but did you know?" And that, I'm afraid, is absolutely inimical to the art of reporting facts, because what this is what's generally known as spin. What the special advisor will give you is their spin on a particular issue. And once you've got a spin, and everyone, and this applies to everyone, you know, lobby journalists are only human, and people come up to you and say that they're giving you an exclusive piece of information, and that to a journalist is gold dust. So if someone comes up to you, so whispers in your ear and says, "Well, you know, no one else knows this, but," then of course, you know, then you prize that information, and that information makes it usually unadulterated by the admission of any specialist journalist who might bring a bit of sense into the equation. That spin usually makes it quite unadulterated into the paper, I'm afraid. And you see this across all papers. So what I think you have to look at, first of all, when you're looking at issues of the reporting of risk, is, you know, who's written the story? Has the story come from the political centre? Has it come from the lobby? If so, it's unlikely to have a great deal of the factual elements that we rely on in order to calculate risk and in order to be able to make reliable assertions of risk in a story. That is the downfall of some aspects of journalism, that there is this division between the political lobby and the rest of newspapers. It's not always the case. There are some cases where, you know, journalists will collaborate on stories where a lobby story will run alongside a more factual story. But just to give you some of the views on politicians on this, I actually, I cannot now count the number of times when I've been ushered into a minister's office to interview him alongside with someone from the lobby, and the minister or his special advisor has quailed at my presence because I'm someone who actually knows some of the facts on the stories that they will be given in that interview. And what usually happens is that ministers prefer, and politicians of all stripes prefer, to talk to non-specialists, because that way they won't face any hard questions. So, contentious, I hope. And I hope that you'll have some questions on it after. but I'll let Tom carry on with the session. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Julie. Kate, over to you for about 5 minutes. You can stay at your seat or go up to the lectern, it's up to you, all the mics are on.
I'll go over here. Right, well, I used to be a lobby journalist. and now I'm a health and science correspondent. I have to say, when I do these things sometimes, I quite often talk about having been a lobby journalist and how much I hated it and how much, in comparison, I really enjoy the job that I'm doing now. And part of that is for some of the reasons that Fee talked about, that I felt as though I spent 2 or 3 years being lied to on a minute-by-minute basis by people who were then double-bluffing and triple-bluffing, and I started to question what reality was, and also that the hatred between politicians and journalists is taxing on a daily basis. And I do find that working with scientists, although they are frustrating in other ways, we don't hate each other as much, I think. I think we feel more that we're working to do the same thing, which is, I think, you know, scientists who are talking to journalists are on the whole trying to tell the public something, and I am on the whole trying to tell the public something, but I'm also trying to entertain them. So we have some things in common, and I feel as though we're working together rather than against each other. I don't know anything about climate science. I report on other things, mostly, as I say, mostly health. But what I wanted to do was pick up on some of Tom's questions at the beginning, and also just throw up a few other stories that I've been involved in over the last 2 or 3 years where risk has been extremely difficult to communicate and has caused not only problems within the story but within our newsroom, that I've had a lot of battles, discussions with my editors about how the story should be written and whether we're doing it in the right way. Tom, his opening question was whether, you know, how journalists would want uncertainty to be communicated to them, whether they want a scientist to be sure or they want them to say, actually, it might be this and we're not sure it could be this. Is balance annoying in a story, or is it necessary, or is it actually essential? And I think that the answer to all of those is yes, it is annoying, it is necessary, and sometimes, and it's essential. The problem is that if you're a journalist, you have to have a first paragraph, you have to have a lead. And so on the whole, journalists come down, they do have balance in the story, or Reuters journalists try to have balance in stories, but they will lead on one side of the argument or one side of it. Sometimes, not very often, but the balance becomes the story, or the uncertainty becomes the story. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was the issue of mobile phones and cancer and whether they cause cancer. And there was a big study called Interphone, which reported out about a year and a half ago. And it was a 10-year study, fantastically expensive, fantastically complicated, took place in loads of countries, hundreds of people involved. And in the end, they didn't know. The answer was, we don't know, we're not sure. And I spent ages trying to figure out how I was going to write this story. And in the end, I decided that I was going to lead on the fact that after 10 years and all this money and all this investigation, we don't know. And I sent it to the editor and he went nuts. He just went nuts. He said, well, you can't say this. You can't write that. But the thing is, he said, well, you will have to say one way or the other. And I said, well, really? I think that this is the strongest way of doing it. And in the end, I won that argument. Many other people went with one way or the other, depending on where their political leaning was or where their particular prejudice was. But I felt that actually, in some ways, more interesting as a science piece was to write that actually sometimes you can look at these things for years and years and years and you do all this study and you still don't know. So the other story that I wanted to talk about was Fukushima, where risk of something that is intangible and unsmellable and unseeable and has all sorts of connotations of diseases that are inherently scary, like cancer, began very, very quickly to massively overtake the actual real risks of flooding and lack of housing and so on. And I'd like to find out what you felt about that story and how it was covered. And also just to highlight one of the main benefits I got from reporting that story, which was, I think, that Reuters as in the newsroom, and I think many other newsrooms, through going through that experience, learned a lot more about how to present risk and how important it is to talk to people like David and Nick and put their elements of interpretation into a story like that. So maybe we can talk more.
Good. Thank you.